This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan MacLeod and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in Isando on Johannesburg's East Rand today to talk to Jan Nisdo, Chief Financial Officer of Teraco Data Environments, Africa's biggest data center operator. Jan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Duncan.
Before we talk Teraco and data centers, tell me a bit about yourself. How long have you been at Teraco now, and what did you do before joining the company?
Sure. So for my sins, I'm a chartered accountant by way of background. Pretty much been a CFO of various IT companies, largely following tech players. So previously, I was with Prism Holdings Limited.
Oh, yes.
And one of the private equity players that was involved in Prism kind of wanted to invest into Teraco, and I was introduced to the founders, and one thing led to another. They happened not to invest, which is a pity for them because I think they would have done quite well out of it, and I landed up staying. So it's one of those matches that kind of got made.
So when was that?
So that was in 2011.
So okay.
I've basically been with Teraco now for close on 8 years.
When did the business start again?
So the business started in 2008.
10 years, okay.
That's our 10th anniversary, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about Teraco and its background. How did the company get its start originally? Who was involved? And what was the idea and how was it launched?
So it's quite an interesting story. So the business started in 2008. I mean, there's a couple of milestones around 2008 as well, because that's when the whole liberalization of the telco sector occurred.
The Altec AutoPage case.
And, you know, the environment moving from 5 lanes licenses to like hundreds, basically, overnight. There were two ISPs in Cape Town that wanted to share basically a data room. And they started talking about sharing this room, and Tim Parsonson, one of the founders, got involved.
Storm Telecom.
Mm. He involved Lex as well, Lex van Wyk, also Storm Telecom. And pretty much it was then decided, well, why not build a small data center, make it a multi-tenant co-location data center facility. And it was basically born on the back of a 500 square meter, 1 megawatt site in Cape Town. And then very quickly on the back of that, the guys decided to expand in Joburg, which is kind of the time that I joined. Initially, the Joburg site was going to be a 2 megawatt site, and it's been a big blur ever since. Basically, one thing led to another, to where we are today.
So it really came out of Storm Telecom originally?
Yeah, originally the founders, correct, out of Storm Telecom.
So. Okay. Is Tim Parsonson still involved? I seem to recall he sold his shares at some
point. So he exited as part of the Primera deal.
Okay.
He was like one of the founders, and basically on the back of the Primera deal, he exited.
Okay. And there were quite a lot of angel investors involved in those early days, right?
Yeah, so originally the business was pretty much, funded by family and friends. So if we go through the funding cycle, it's one of these base cases for any kind of university lecture potentially. So very much family and friends initially. In fact, there was Guy Wilner who pretty much started a company called IX Europe, which landed up being Equinix's European data center arm. So Equinix is probably one of the largest players internationally in the vendor-neutral data center space. And he landed up investing in Teraco as well. And we went through a series of fundraisers. So there's a Series A and a Series B, which pretty much was kind of family and friends. And then I think Series C is when things got kind of serious. So there we wanted to really expand the business. We wanted to go to Durban. We wanted to enlarge the Joburg facility. And we landed up introducing the IFC and Development Bank of South Africa, which is also in itself a great story because they really achieved what they're supposed to achieve, basically putting in capital potentially into businesses that at that point in time weren't necessarily fundable, and achieving that developmental mandate. So that was Series C. About 2 years later, we pretty much outgrew that facility, and then we started going to the commercial banks to try and raise capital. We ended up striking a relationship with APSA. I think maybe on the back of kind of their Barclays know-how at the time.
Yeah.
They had deep IT knowledge in London. And our first facility with APSA was in the region of about 160 million rand. And now 5 years later, we've got a 1.8 billion facility with them. So it's been a great story all around.
It's debt funding. They don't own a share in the business.
No, so it's purely debt funding.
Yeah. Okay. So how much has Teraco invested in infrastructure since its formation?
So we've invested in the region of probably about 2 billion rand across all the various data centers. And then we're in the process of developing a larger site, so enlarging the campus, and that's going to be quite a sizable build. So that'll be in the region of 2.5 billion rand.
Plus so more than double what you've already invested.
Correct. And it'll be done in phases, so it's not all going to be done at the same point in time. Probably the first phase will be in the region of about 1 billion rand.
Well, you've just very kindly given me a tour of the facilities, and you've just broken ground across the road here on this expansion. When is that going to be ready for service?
So we've started to break ground, basically demolitions and groundworks. That normally takes about 2 months. And then the build itself, it takes longer than one normally expects. And that's because, firstly, just the Isando site, so we're a bit restricted on space. So we go multi-level as opposed to like the facility we have in Bredell, where we have a large amount of space that we can build on. And then just the structure itself, you know, the racks themselves can weigh anywhere in the region of 1 to 1.5 tons. So the structure needs to be, you know, lots of steel, highly dependable. And that just results in the build taking, you know, a bit of time. So we think we're going to go live probably in the region of Q3 next year.
Is it much more expensive to build a multi-story data center than one that's just on the ground floor?
Yeah, the build costs are dramatically different just because of the structure. So the structure ends up having far more steel. It's got to be able to withstand the vibrations of the generators when they kick in. And then also to be able to take the load of the computer equipment itself. Plus the chillers end up going on the roof. So it's there's some engineering maths that goes into the building.
Yeah, but it still made sense to build a multi-story one rather than finding land somewhere else and building it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at the campus hub here in Isando, you know, we've obviously invested a lot of money, but our customers have invested, you know, an absolute amount of fortune amount of money as well, just by way of all the fiber that's come to the site.
Yeah.
So when we started off, you know, the Joburg site in 2010, there was very little fiber in the area. Now it's probably the most dense fibered area in the whole of the African continent. There's just so much fiber coming here. So for us, it's just a natural extension to, you know, to make sure our customers don't have to duplicate their investments.
And how do you see this particular site here expanding over the coming years? Obviously, you're building across the road. I see you have some sort of satellite data port across from where the construction is happening. You've just built a new section to the campus here, which is now live. Does this become an ICT hub in Johannesburg at some point? Do you see IT businesses potentially coming into this area?
So I think ultimately it will happen. So I think just on the data centers itself, we've pretty much got it wrong. So our forecasts, every year we've just landed up outgrowing the forecasts. Mm. So, you know, this extension that we did, the original site's some 6 megawatts. The extension that we did was 14 megawatts. And we thought that it was going to last, I don't know, you know, 4, 5, 6 years before we'd have to build again. And the reality is, you know, 2 years on and we're now doing this campus expansion. This site combined is about 20 megawatts and the expansion is going to be 60 megawatts. So we're hoping that we're not going to have to build again in another 2 years. So obviously there's a longer term focus now. So we've taken off, you know, quite a lot of power. And we think, you know, it'll take us a while to basically, you know, fill out that space, probably in the region of like 5 years.
So once that new phase is completed, then you're looking at an 80 megawatt facility.
Yeah, it's 80 megawatts.
That's a heck of a lot of electricity. You must be one of the biggest electricity users in the country.
So, I think once we get to full power usage, absolutely we'll be one of the top power users. But there's a good side to that story as well. So I think we're a net energy saver, because if you think about all this computer equipment and if it was sitting in, you know, clients or enterprises' data centers, those data centers tend to be, you know, less efficient, not fully populated, probably not running as optimally as how we're running our data center. And the reason why we're able to do it is because it's obviously fully populated. And that's where the efficiencies start to kick in. So with regards to the grid itself, we're probably a net energy saver, I'd say, because through aggregating all this computer equipment, we're able to.
That's very interesting because you see headlines about how much energy data centers are consuming, and environmentalists saying, cloud computing, it's fantastic, but it's going to destroy the planet. But in effect, what you're saying is that data centers like Terraco and others around the world are going to reduce energy consumption.
I'd say net cloud computing, that obviously is increasing consumption, but if you took all the computer equipment that was within Terraco, so let's just say the 20 megawatts, so there's about 10 megawatts IT behind the 20 megawatts in our campus facility, and then you went and you distributed that back into all the various enterprises, be it standing in an office somewhere or in a small computer room or an inefficient data center, that probably would have consumed quite easily 30 megawatts or 35 megawatts. So I think that's kind of the way to use it. But with regards to environmentalists and how much IT power data centers are consuming, I mean, that's the reality. So I think the stats worldwide is like 3% of all electricity consumption is going into data centers.
Good grief.
And I don't think it's going to stop. If you just look at, you know the stats about like data, how every year it basically multiplies the number of data records. So it's definitely not going to stop. Just the proliferation of, online devices, so be it wearable tech like a watch or a car. You can imagine how many sensors are in a car, all producing some form of data. It all has to come back to a mothership at some point in time, which is a data center. And just cloud computing, everyone talks about cloud computing, but it all resides in a data center somewhere, consuming electricity.
So you've got multiple data centers around the country now. You've got the one in Cape Town, which I believe has also been expanded quite a lot since those initial investments. You've got a small facility in Durban, and you've got the Sysanda facility. You've got one in Bredell, which is on the other end of the airport.
Correct.
What are the facilities typically used for? I mean, why would someone, for example, host in Bredell as opposed to here in Isando?
So it's a good question. I think, the nature of the facilities are slightly different. So between the various sites, we have about 50 megawatts of power. The Isando sites and Cape Town sites are pretty much interconnect hubs. So, if we compare ourselves to these highly connected data centers around the world, you've got these hotspots of interconnection taking place, and the places around the world where that happens is there's a place called NAP of the Americas in Miami, which was an old Verizon data center, where you have a lot of connectivity coming through from South America and America, and a great deal of interconnection taking place there. Then pretty much in Amsterdam, a highly connected environment, the Docklands in London, Sydney, Hong Kong. And in those kind of environments, the highly connected data centers, which you can measure it by power, or you can measure it by number of interconnects. And those interconnects run in each of those sites anywhere from, say, 6,000 to about 15,000 interconnects. Well, here in our center, we've got something like 8,000 interconnects. We've got 12,000 across all our data centers. And it just goes to show the amount of interconnection that's taking place. So I think, when the business started, we were very much telco-focused. Pretty much like a telly house in London. And we started off with some 20, 30, 40 carriers. And the proposition was largely also on the back of obviously the Altec court case as well, where all these VANS license holders wanted to meet on a neutral meeting ground. And Terraco allowed that to happen because we don't really charge for transit. We basically interconnect. So it's a notional cost of an interconnect every month. And then we started to grow into other sectors. So on the back of the telco sector, which today sits at around about 200 telcos, pretty much every major telco on the African continent has some form of node here at Terraco. And on the back of the telcos, we targeted the content providers. And for the content providers, it made sense to come to Terraco because they had the ability with basically, one point of distribution to hit all the various networks. So, if I take some of the content providers that are on Terraco, instead of deploying in Angola, in Malawi, in Mozambique, in all the various data centers in South Africa, basically by deploying in Terraco, you're able to hit all those networks in one shot. And it's also accelerated the content to come, A, to Africa, and B, to come to, obviously, to Terraco, to South Africa, because these content providers were able to hit so many eyeballs off basically one distribution mechanism. So instead of doing multiple deployments through one deployment, which is kind of how they measure their business case, their business models. They're able to hit all these multiple markets. So in some way, we've basically accelerated the content providers potentially coming, to the continent as well. So we've got this telco sector, we've got the content sector, and then we started to move into other verticals like financial services, outsources, and basically enterprise. So today we've got some 450 customers. Indirectly, we probably have in the region of about 1,000, because a lot of our customers as well are large outsources that will basically house other enterprises in our facility.
And does it make sense? I mean, you mentioned the rest of Africa and how content providers, for example, will choose to build here and then distribute into all of those markets because it's too expensive to build in every single African market. Does it make sense, though, for Teraco to potentially look in the future at building data centers in other African territories, maybe a hub for East Africa, a hub for West Africa?
So that's a good question. We get asked that a lot. A couple of ways to answer that question. The first one is there needs to be a fertile environment for a vendor-neutral data center. So in a lot of these markets, there is a market for a data center operator, but typically it would be for the telco-owned use, as opposed to provisioning the services of any new data center. And the reason why I say that, in South Africa and worldwide, where we've got a vibrant telco sector, a lot of license holders, a business like ours can flourish. But where you have only one or two carriers, it becomes a little bit more difficult for a business kind of like ours to evolve and flourish. So we're going to take kind of a wait and see approach. I mean, the two big markets are Nigeria and Kenya. Those are very interesting. I don't think we're going to do it organically. I think we're going to, there are a couple of operators that have started, and we'll see how they grow, and then hopefully at some point in time make our first acquisition.
Yeah. But the opening up of the market here in 2008 played, it sounds like that was a pivotal moment that really allowed this business to become what it's become.
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, on the back of that, and it's been great for the whole of South Africa, it's been great for the whole region, right? Because, mm-hmm. Everyone benefits from the cost of low transit, low internet costs, low bandwidth. We've all played our part in that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you one more question before we move on about power. You're going to have 80 megawatts here. That's a heck of a lot of electricity. Are there options to generate your own electricity? Have you looked at that at all? Solar, wind, or is that... is that not really feasible for the amount of power you consume here?
So in South Africa, it becomes quite difficult because we have to buy from typically the municipality that you're in. Having said that, I mean, one can always enter into offtake agreements, and I think the environment for that is changing. So it's not a no forever, I guess. Also, our take, so our demand for electricity is pretty much flatlined at the same number. So we don't have high power usage during the day where we can rely on solar, and then at night the power requirements drop off. The KVA requirements are pretty much flatlined. So it becomes quite difficult because then you'll end up investing in a solar farm and having electricity off-grid, and you kind of land up investing in two sets of infrastructure. So that at this point in time, we haven't considered that.
And load shedding? Touch wood, it hasn't been too much of an issue lately, but you were saying about 3-4 years ago it was a big issue. I know that you're on the same power grid here as OR Tambo International Airport. It's got a great
the super sub
station. So you're probably less prone to it here, but you've got other data centers around the country. When load shedding happens, how badly does it affect you guys?
Yeah, it certainly rattles your nerves because you realize that you're running on on your N plus one. So you realize that you're running on your generators, and the chances of failure happening start becoming elevated. But also it's a way to test your systems. So throughout the load shedding cycles and environment, fortunately we didn't have any downtime. Those are the positive aspects of it. I guess where we are located, so we like the environment where we're located, so we have a very stable grid here in Ekurhuleni. We have access to great power, we've got a good relationship with the municipality, and that's why we've decided to expand our facilities here. But at time of load shedding, it's amazing. The different data centers have got different load shed cycles, and some get, you know, hit more than others just by virtue of where they're located.
The generators you have downstairs are quite spectacular in terms of their size. You must also store a lot of diesel on site, which must be quite a logistical exercise as well. But when the power does go out, it must make one heck of a racket, right?
I was talking about how we build our buildings. So basically the whole building, you know, you can feel when these generators get turned on. You know, on this site we've got 14 generators, so that, you know, that
14
all turn up on this at the same time, and then basically seven at any point in time would run. So it does make a hum. In fact, we've got earbuds, so if you walk downstairs and the generator happens to turn on, you've got to put them in, otherwise you might go hard of hearing.
So there are a lot of data center operators around in South Africa, but Teraco has outgrown them all. Is that largely due to the fact that you're carrier neutral, do you think, or is there something else at play?
Yeah, I think it's as a result of the changing market and how the market's evolved. I wouldn't say we've outgrown them all. So we're quite humble in the way we see ourselves. So
you are the biggest.
So we are the biggest, but we still like to remain humble. I think there's a market for different types of data centers. So I think obviously the data centers that are owned by the telcos and by the outsourcers, they still have their place to play, and that's because some customers want a cradle to grave solution. They want from A to Z. Whereas at Teraco, it's a different kind of a customer that would come to Teraco. I think we've managed to, what we have done over the last couple of years is managed to convince a large amount of larger enterprises and kind of the banks that potentially building data centers going forward is perhaps not the wisest thing to do, and for a variety of reasons. So I think a lot of the infrastructure is old. And it was built probably 6 or 7 or 8 years ago when, Eskom was a little bit different. We didn't have the load shedding cycles. And also maybe the availability of the environment didn't have to be as high availability as it is now. I mean, now the consequence of downtime is till's not operating or till's not working. It's basically business downtime. So the environment's very much changed. And we've been telling the enterprises that, hang on a second, to go and invest in a data center which you're not too sure how full it's going to be in the future, is it really a wise investment decision to make? And what I mean by that is, obviously, it's the prevalence of cloud. So all the large cloud operators are coming to South Africa. And if you look at the stats worldwide, it's predicting somewhere in the region of like 20% of work streams are currently in the cloud, and that's going to move to 50-60% over the next 2 to 3 years, if you look at the stats in America. So in that kind of environment, why would you want to invest in a data center which, you know, potentially is only going to house half the things that it's housing today? So we think we're making some inroads there.
So let's talk a bit about the Pamira deal that happened back in 2015. How did that deal come about? Did they take a majority stake in the business at that time?
So I think, yeah, you know, if we go back to how the business was funded, so the business was funded by really venture capitalists, family and friends, and in 2014, most of them had been invested for in the region of 6 years, and some of them were actively looking for a liquidity event. Some wanted to go overseas as well. So I think, you know, one thing led to another, and we ended up going through a process. It wasn't really a South African-focused process because we wanted to remain vendor neutral. So our big thing was that we didn't want to be owned by a telco, and I think we've outgrown those fears now today. But at the time, in 2014, the big fear was that potentially we would become a telco, which we definitely don't ever want to become. So the focus was more around kind of overseas trade buyers and private equity. And Lex, myself, and the management team were having such a fun time. We're still having a great time. We're really enjoying the business. And I think, you know, one thing led to another, and we ended up selling to Primera. And Primera prevailed over the other private equity buyers in that they really understood that the business should, you know, shouldn't be hamstruck with debt. So a lot of the other private equity guys wanted to put a lot of debt into the business. So not only would we have to fund our future builds, but also service debt for acquiring the equity, which just, especially now, it just would not have made any sense. And they basically put an all-equity transaction. They're also a great bunch of guys, highly knowledgeable in the industry. It was a great partnership got struck up, and we both benefited out of that relationship.
So how involved are they in the business?
Yeah, they're quite involved. I mean, it's one of the sectors that they have a lot of focus on, so they're very much focused on tech, but then also within tech itself, they have a deep understanding of the data center market. So it's something they understand extremely well.
But they're a private equity player. Does that mean they're looking for an exit at some point? And could that possibly mean a listing for Terrica?
Premier has been invested in us for going on, I guess, 4 years. When that window closes, we don't know, but ultimately it will close at some point in time. The reality is we haven't given it much consideration. We've kind of got this business plan, and we're trying to execute on the business plan as best we can. The future will tell. We haven't committed ourselves either way.
All right, those discussions are still to happen in the future. I was just curious. I was chatting to Sevir Ramdani from Seacom a couple of weeks ago about the impact of Seacom in the market. We were talking a bit about Terrica. We've seen so much investment over the last 10 years in undersea cables around the African continent, and there's still more coming. I think there's at least 3 or 4 new cables that are in the works at the moment. But with companies like Netflix and Amazon and all the big content providers and cloud providers coming into the market very often through Terrica, what impact do you think that's going to have on demand for undersea cables? Because a lot of the bandwidth now is being brought, people are consuming content that's hosted inside Terrica. Does that take away some of the argument for all of these undersea cables that are being built?
No, I think it's actually going to be the opposite. So I think there's just this tsunami of data. And the more data gets consumed, the more consumers and the more business consume cloud or data products. I think you're going to have a combination of, both overseas and international transit and local transit increasing. So I think net-net, there's going to be explosion in both. Mm-hmm. There's definitely going to be more undersea cables, and there's definitely going to be more fiber networks laid in South Africa and the African continent. So I honestly see it as a tsunami. It's not going to stop.
Yeah, and before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about NAP Africa, Internet Exchange Point, Internet Peering Point. What's the correct terminology for it?
So it's an Internet Exchange.
Okay. So the Internet Service Providers Association has for many years run the Jinx, Sinx, and Dinx exchanges around the country. NAP Africa came in. What does it do differently to those three exchanges, or is it a direct competitor to them?
I wouldn't say we're a competitor. We pretty much do the same thing that they do. In 2012-2013, we approached the incumbent exchange and asked them if they wanted to basically lay down the exchange in Terrica. Mm. They declined at that point in time, and we realized that it was absolutely vital to basically kickstart the internet in South Africa. So we decided to create our own internet exchange called NAP Africa. I mean, it's a tremendous story. Today we have some 300 peers on the exchange, all the major content providers, pretty much every telco. A lot of businesses that are in charge of their networks are peering on the exchange as well. We've got something like nearly 500 gigs of peak traffic. And in terms of the internet exchange relative to the size relative to other internet exchanges, we rank number 8 in EMEA. So by itself, it's a large exchange. And again, it's just as a result of all these African carriers coming to pick up all the content here in South Africa. So it's been a fantastic story.
Just take us through what the significance is of a peering point or an exchange point like this. What does it mean for consumers? What does it mean for the guys who are providing these services?
So I think, traditionally an internet exchange has been an exchange mechanism between a carrier and a content delivery network. And or maybe the way to look at it is between a carrier and a content provider. So someone that wants to provide content and then a carrier that wants to distribute it, mm-hmm. they basically want to meet at a central place. They want to have the ability to easily meet, so they don't want to go through convoluted networks to go and get the content or, you know, pick up the content. And an internet exchange does it, and it does it on a no-cost basis. So basically, you're pairing traffic with one another at zero cost. So it's not like there's transit involved in getting this traffic. And that's key, because that allows networks to pick up content and content to distribute at a very low cost. And then lastly, it improves reliability. So instead of having this, you know, network that's kind of distributed across multiple locations, by having it in one key location, you know, everyone knows where they can go and pick up the content and vice versa. So it just adds to the resilience of the environment. And then for the end consumer, you know, the person that's viewing something on their phone, viewing Netflix, you know, in their house, it just makes it so much faster. So, you know, the latency involved, it just reduces the latency. So, you know, in the old days when you used to watch that little circle turn and turn and turn, either on your phone or, you know, however you used to view
the
Netflix 5 years ago, you know, now you're able to, you know, depending on the bandwidth that you've got to your home, it's basically instantly distributed.
Great. Jan Nisdo is Chief Financial Officer of Terraco Data Environment. Jan, it's been great. Thank you for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan. Pleasure.